This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. John Williams is an educator. He strongly believes that his students should come to class ready to learn. But he also knows that it's his responsibility is even greater. It is that he needs to set them up for success. So when John Williams was asked to lead an alternative high school in Chapel Hill, his first goal was to change the learning environment. Phoenix Academy High School is a small institution where there are no school resource officers, suspensions are uncommon, and students get behavioral counseling on campus from John Williams himself. And it's working. The U.S. Education Department recognized Phoenix Academy this year as a model school for its behavioral intervention programs. Maybe that is evidence of something John is often fond of saying about his students. They are not problem children. They are children with problems. John Williams is principal of Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill and joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome back, John. Good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. Good to see you again.
Talk about the early days in that school itself, the Phoenix School. You had several conversations with the superintendent of Chapel Hill Carborough Schools about what you needed to succeed. What did you ask him?
Well, one of the things that I did, I realized that we was a comprehensive high school. We graduate students, we promote students, everything else. And I knew that the teachers that I served there were going to be judged and rated by the same standard of the teachers at the other high schools. So one of the things I asked, I spoke to the superintendent about, I said, if that is the case, one of the things that I need to do, I need to have some control or some say on how we move forward with working with the students that we serve, including the application process, a review of what we needed to do with the students before they ever arrived and everything else. And in that line of thinking, I got 100% support, and we were able to put together the whole process. We are a referral school where students are referred to us. Many other times it's because of academic issues, but the biggest thing was that superintendent just wanted us to be a successful school and gave me those resources.
So who does go to the school? Who is referred to you?
It's a range of students that are referred to us. Of course, the students typically are students who realize they are not able to be successful in the traditional academic setting. Or when you're looking at a school with 900 to 1,500 students, like the other high schools, the other three high schools in the district, sometimes a student gets lost, and they realize they've gotten lost in the whole process, and they want to be successful, and they may put in a request to their social worker, their school social worker, a counselor, one of their administrators, and be referred. Well, sometimes the teachers, counselors, school social workers, and administrators recognize the same issue with a student, and they may make that referral after having a conversation with the student. And we will accept that student too, or we'll sit down and see if we can actually meet that student's academic needs. And we will accept that student. And of course, we do accept the students who have gotten into some serious issues at the other school. When I say serious, like maybe some trouble with either substance abuse or bringing marijuana or drugs on campus or something of that nature, or just being very disruptive, and the superintendent, instead of long-term suspending these students out of the school for the year, he will recommend they attend Phoenix Academy, and we'll go through the application process with them as well.
There can be a correlation. I mean, if you're falling behind already and you're getting to middle and high school and you're just not doing well, there can be a correlation, or is there, with discipline problems. You can start acting out because you're just not keeping up.
I think most educators and people who are working in the field of education sees that immediately. I mean, when the student is inside of the classroom and they may have a learning disability that no one has diagnosed, or they may have gotten so far behind through their previous years, then they're not able to keep up with the work. Their focus is somewhere else, and they become disruptive. And sometimes they're disruptive simply out of stress and frustration, being inside of the classroom and not being able to learn. And sometimes they're just bored and says, I'm not learning this. I'm going to act up a little bit. So you're right, Frank. That's exactly what you see. And it repeats itself to the point where it's like a ball rolling down the hill. It just begins to pick up the steam until it hits the bottom and there's nothing left. And
you were also clear with the superintendent about having some kind of a process by which you would accept and screen some of these students. In other words, you weren't going to take just everybody they gave you, right?
Right. To an extent, that is part of the process. We go through an application process at the beginning and mid part of the year. after we've had our graduations to try to screen students that we can best serve. Sometimes there are students who may not meet our criteria because we're just not able to meet all of their needs.
So what are those criteria, and who's how many students then don't get into Phoenix and aren't being served by the school system?
There's always a waiting list. Yeah. That's a waiting list. We've been, this team that I serve and I have the pleasure of working with are absolutely superb. They are just unbelievable. And because of that, people are knocking at the door to try to get into Phoenix. We find some students who definitely can be successful at the high schools, and we don't need to take that student. We need to give them a chance to work out being successful. So we coordinate, talk to the other school and staff to try to make sure they receive the services. But on the other hand, we receive students who are academically in jeopardy of possibly becoming a dropout in the future. And when I say that, Frank, it's important to understand that many of the, almost all of the students, I would say 99%+ of the students that we serve, they may have academic issues, but there's typically something else that is impacting their ability to learn. And those are things that are more associated with our social environment, economic, and then other things that's going on, sometimes emotional or just anxiety and stress and stuff like that that they deal with in the school setting.
Well, we're going to talk more about how you meet those needs, but I want to find out who teaches at the school. What's the application and screening process for teachers?
We go through an extensive process to select our teachers. Of course, I have a team that works with me at times, depending on the nature of the position, such as our English as a second language teacher who works with students where English is their second language. One of the other positions, our EC resource position, teacher position, we coordinate with the district staff who they have directors over those programs, and they work with us very, very closely on screening the applicants and who meets all of the qualifications and certifications. But whenever we go through the actual interview process, everybody looks good on paper typically and when they're applying to be an educator and coming into the school system. But what you're looking for is someone who really feels a calling to be in the profession, that they really feel as though this is where they're supposed to be, and they want to be on the forefront of what I call the front lines of helping some of the most disadvantaged or disenfranchised type students in the district. And those are the ones that I look for. I remember hiring one of my staff, and as she was walking out, or she was finishing up the interview, she thanked us for the interview process. And this was the final decision. And she said, I appreciate you interviewing. I hope I do have the position, but I do want you to know that this is the type of environment that I want to work at. I want to work with students who have the greater needs, where no one else is stepping up to the plate to serve. And that was my decision. That was like, that's all I needed to hear. So,
talking with Phoenix Academy High School Principal John Williams today on the state of things. How about your schedule? Is that different from the high schools in Chapel Hill?
Our schedule is pretty unique. What the other high schools use is a traditional high school schedule where they're teaching up to 6 to 7 classes. 6 or 7 classes a day is what the students are taking. At Phoenix Academy, we're on what they call a block schedule. So we're unique in that situation. And it benefits the students that come to our school in several ways. But first of all, because we're on a block schedule, instead of teaching 7 classes where a student's able to get 7 credits in a year, they can actually receive 8 credits. Now, the benefit of that is if a student is coming to us that is already academically compromised, we're able to immediately get them ahead. So they'll take 4 classes for the first semester from August until mid-January, and then they'll pick up their second 4 classes and they'll take those.
You don't have an SRO in your a resource officer in your school?
No.
Why not?
You know, it's funny. It's funny, and why I laugh is because they've given me funds for that position to fill that position. I just can't bring myself to do it. The students, like I said, I don't have criminals in the school that I serve. the students are some who have gotten a little sidetracked, but they're not much different than I was when I was a kid, you know, coming up, and just need some direction and someone to care. And recently we found out that we're going to be expanding, at least because of some of the long-term suspensions, we're becoming a little bit larger. And I called up and I asked one of the assistant superintendents, I said, can I take those funds and get another teacher instead of, and I was talking to one of the high school principals, the principal at Chapel Hill High School, and she said, John, that's the difference. Instead of you thinking about discipline, you're thinking about education. And that is what I think about. I think about the importance of educating the students academically, socially, in every way, mentally, spiritually, in every way. How do I continue to look at the whole student instead of just, I got students I need to control?
Well, of course, the argument for SROs is that you can't get to the education because of the disruption, but apparently you're not seeing that kind of disruption, or it's handled in a different way when you do have disruption.
And that, I think that's part, Frank, why we are a model PBIS school. I am proud of that. The team, once again, that I serve, and the students that I have the opportunity to serve, they are just amazing in the work they do to show the students that they care. I mean, I was leaving the school today and one of my students had an appointment, and my social worker is making sure she makes it. You know, these are things that doesn't have to happen. This child has parents and someone responsible, but they can't do it, and we fill the gap, and that's what it's all about.
Talking to John Williams today, principal of Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill. We'll continue that conversation and find out how John got there when you listen to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. I'm talking this hour with John Williams, principal of Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill. It's an alternative high school. It's been recognized as a model institution for its behavioral intervention programs. So how many students at Phoenix, and what's the student-teacher ratio?
Right now, we have about 42 students at Phoenix at this time. We're looking at going up to about approximately about 45, maybe before the end of the school year, the beginning of the next school year in January, depending on who is referred over the next few weeks. We have about 14 staff members, and that includes part-time staff. We have a teacher who is one period where he coaches in the morning, my PE teacher, and we have a part-time ESL teacher, and we have a part-time nurse, and the rest we have staff.
So that is a way better student-teacher ratio than in the public schools,
mm-hmm.
which I suppose suggests that, I mean, again, this question of, well, how am I going to keep order in this school so that there can be education? Maybe it's by improving the teacher-student ratio. In other words, it might just cost more to educate a student than we're paying.
Well, that's where you have to put your money at. You really do have to put your money into educating the children. Now, keep in mind, all the staff that I just mentioned, we have a lot of support staff, the teacher assistants, the counselor, social worker, our bookkeeper, secretary, who holds the same position. So in actuality, we probably only have 7 teachers in the school who are actually full-time or certified teachers or educators. But our classroom sizes are anywhere between 3 to 4 students up to 10 students. We max out at 10 students. But what that allows to happen is the teachers get to know their students. And they're able to tailor their instructions specifically to an individual student's needs. It makes all the difference in the world. So knowing the student and then being able to adapt your academic strategies to approach and address that student needs, that's critical. And it engages the student, so it works well.
You are a certified and trained counselor, and you do counseling. Do you do that? Do you wait for a student to be referred to you? How well do you know the students, and when do you personally intervene?
Every student that comes to Phoenix Academy meets with me personally. My social worker and counselor, and sometimes the EC resource teacher, and every now and then, the licensed clinical social worker on our team, But every student meets with me prior to attending Phoenix, and I get to know them. I get to know why they're there. Well, what are their needs immediately? And I get to meet their families, which I'm a big proponent on making sure families are engaged with the school. In fact, I have an open door policy that is so liberal. It's amazing because I tell parents you're invited at any time. I don't care when. You don't have to tell me that you're out here on the campus. Sign in. Come in, sit in on the class, check on your child. You can eat lunch with them. The only thing that I asked if you go into the classroom is that you do not interrupt instruction. You can participate if the teacher engages you, but don't interrupt. But you can come at any time, and I don't even need to know.
I wonder how that plays out. You know, John, I taught for 6 years in an alternative school, and one of the things I noticed is that when students detect, especially when they first get there, that you really care about them, there is a testing period, and it's rough. And there's a, I mean, they're looking to see if you mean it. And to do that, there's a lot of acting out. And I just wonder if that's happened to you, if you find that kids try to test and make sure that you're serious about it. And what you do when you actually, and the real question is, when you have a discipline, a kid acts out and there's a problem, how do you handle it?
You know, we have a lot of students that have some behavioral concerns. It's something that they have grown accustomed to. Sometimes, you know, people call it addicted to chaos. But, you know, I think the biggest thing that we do as a team is we don't take it personal. I mean, it's just so important to realize this is a child. You can't take it personal. And so I was at the school and a student cursed me out. It was so bad. Called me everything that you wouldn't want to be called. And he called me up later on, 20 minutes later, and I said, hey, how you doing? And he was shocked, like, what's going on? And I held him accountable for what he did, but I let him know, hey, listen, I didn't take it personal.
But that particular episode, or maybe one like it, came to the attention of the superintendent, right?
And yes, I actually went over to the superintendent because I didn't feel anything as far as wanting to discipline that child for what he did. The part where he left campus without permission, yes, that was a different issue, and I had to hold him accountable. But all the name calling, the way I looked at it, Frank, is that I'm sitting up here as the principal. I had the authority to suspend. I had the authority to recommend long-term suspension. I had his cell phone, and I couldn't return that at that time because of the policy. So his grandmother had to come pick that up. But what was important is that I realized at that moment, all he was doing was fighting me with the only weapon he had. And that was he could say some ugly words and fuss. I can't be upset when I sit up there and I knew that fully, no matter what he said, it didn't change my authority or my role. Neither did it change my responsibility in making sure I continue to take care of this child. So I was not going to let that be affected, and it doesn't. And 90% of the team that we serve are pretty much in that same place all the time.
And you've made it clear to your students that if there's any controversy or a conflict or contradiction in a story, you're going to take your teacher's word over the students.
I do. You asked me earlier about the vetting process for the teachers that I serve. I trust the teachers that I serve, and I tell the students and their parents when they first enroll or come in for the interview and the application interview that I will always take my teacher's side. And the reason why, and this is for the parents' benefit, they don't want me to have a teacher working in this school that I don't trust. And I fully trust the team that I serve. And when I say that, I have a reason. If you saw how the teachers would stay late and work with the students or bring the students' concerns to me or to make sure that everyone has something to eat each day. We recently, last Thursday, we had our holiday dinner for our entire school family and community members and everything. There was probably close to 100 people at the program. If you've seen how the teachers came together with bringing the food, setting everything up, grabbing the students, letting them help and be a part of it, you'll understand why I trust them completely with each and every child that I serve.
Well, I'm going to find out how you came to this profession. You grew up in Greene County, North Carolina, and one of five children?
Yes, I'm the youngest of five.
Youngest of five, and didn't have a lot of money. Tell us about your upbringing.
Well, Frank. We were just extremely poor. Some people used to call it Poe. You couldn't afford the O in the middle. You know, we were in that shape, in that situation where we just didn't have a lot at our disposal, and there wasn't a lot of resources and a lot of extra. Started working in the tobacco fields when I was 5 years old. Back then, we used mules, and I was able to drive the mule cart. I don't know where child services and stuff was at that time. All I know is that I was up early in the morning before a lot of other people out there with my father and my four brothers, and we worked. And I was able to eventually, at 15 years old, start working at the bus garage in the county as a little mechanic helper. And eventually drove school bus my last year in high school.
You didn't have much confidence in your own ability in school, did you?
No, well, I never had anyone that I can remember ever mention going to college or anything else. And there was other dynamics that's going on. When you don't have a lot and you don't have a lot of exposure, you just don't know really what's out there in the world. Mm. So no, there wasn't a lot of confidence. So I felt pretty lucky that I graduated. In fact, I didn't find out I was going to graduate until the day of graduation. Mm. That's kind of sad, you know, when you have to go to your rooms and find out, did you pass this class? And but it worked out. So
we talked about those very early years. I mean, I think you were sharecropping, right?
Yes. We typically lived on someone else's property. And if we lived on their property, then they pretty much had us working for them and doing the work for their farm and their field. Yeah.
And you were not excelling in school. What was your sense of your future as a young man while you were going to high school? What did you think you were going to be doing?
You know, I never thought about what I was going to be doing in high school. And it never crossed my mind. I was just living for the moment as best I could. Got into a little bit of trouble. And I got hurt in a couple of situations. And I winded up, the Air Force recruiter came by at the beginning of my 12th grade year. I had been taken out of the house because I was acting up and being a little pain. And when the recruiter came by, I saw it and I took an interest in it. And I had taken the ASVAB, the military exam, entrance exam before, but I had not scored high enough to go into the Air Force. And the recruiter told me, said, if you really want to go into the Air Force, take the exam over and see. Well, this time I actually tried. I hadn't tried before. And I did well. And I graduated on June the 11th. I stayed home on June the 12th. And I left to go into the military for 20 years on June the 13th.
What kind of work did you do in the Air Force?
My first 14 and a half years, I was what they call an aerospace ground equipment technician. And I worked on all of the aircraft equipment that supported the aircraft when it was on the ground, the turbine compressors, high pressure units, hydraulic systems that they connected to the aircraft to help it move. They could test systems and work on systems when the aircraft was sitting on the ground. And my last six years was as a counselor. I worked in behavioral science, and I had finished my first master's degree and requested to go over there, and they approved it, which was unheard of.
You didn't see combat, but you were close a few times, right?
Yeah, I was in Korea in 1980 when the president of Korea at the time, Park Chung-hee, was assassinated. At first, they thought it was the North Koreans, and I was in South Korea at the time, and they thought it was the North Koreans who had assassinated him, and we went on alert, and I was up near the DMZ, near the militarized zone, stationed on an army base, even though I was in the Air Force. And of course, they issued us our weapons and we set up around the perimeter just in case we thought that there was going to be a war. And we found out that it was done inside. It was one of his cabinet members that had assassinated him. And the other time that I was really close to combat was when I was landing in Saudi Arabia and Anwar Sadat had been assassinated. Mm. And once again, we thought we were going into some kind of war zone at the time. And I was very, very fortunate to miss that. I did volunteer to go to Desert Storm, but I was a single parent at that time, and they did not let me go. I went back and took my children to their mother for a short visit, and then came back to volunteer again, but they didn't need my services.
So now you go from Greene County. You've been a little bit around the world, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and you said when you were there growing up, you didn't really have much of a sense of the big wide world or even a sense of your own future. How were things changing for you in your own sense of who you were and where you were going when you were in the military?
You know, there was one person that I met. His name's Chief Edward Patterson. I met him when I was stationed at Myrtle Beach Air Force Base. And the reason why I met him is actually because of his daughter. Please, guys, don't read into that. She was actually a dating a friend of mine. Uh-huh. And he PCS'd, transferred to Japan. And I still hung out with her sometime and went over to her house sometimes just to hang out. And he started talking to me about going to school. And I eventually tried to convince him that I wasn't smart enough to take college classes. You know, it was just it wasn't even close to being in my mind to go to college. And in order to get him to leave me alone, I decided I was going to sign up for one class, take this class, fail that class, and he would leave me alone. And I took the class. It was an English 101 English grammar. And I got a C out of that class. I received a C. I called the instructor up because I thought I had failed the class, but she had given me a C, and she told me that, no, I had done well. I needed to look at my test, and I got credit for participation, attendance, and my tests weren't that bad. And that was one of the things that changed my life, and it changed it significantly.
So you were calling to tell her she made a mistake.
Yes.
That you should have failed. And she was saying, actually, didn't she tell you if you'd worked
a little bit harder? She said you missed a B by 2 points. And I will tell you this, is a real personal side. I went back to my dorm. I was in the dormitory at the time, and I went back to the dorm, and it was a Friday evening. And I remember closing my door. And then at that time, they had a sink, a mirror, and stuff in your dorm room. And you shared the shower in other areas of the with another room next to you. And it had doors that could lock you off so that you didn't have to walk in on anyone. But I remember locking myself in my room for the entire weekend from Friday evening until Monday morning. And periodically, I would get up and go to the mirror and look at myself and says, you know, who's in there? You know, I just could not believe that I passed a college class. So, and I had to figure that out. I had to try to figure out, like, what am I capable of? And from that point, I've come now to the point where I still don't know what I'm capable of because I can do pretty much anything I put my mind to.
What did you do next?
I went to Korea and I was assessed. I wanted to take some more classes because now I found out that I could take college classes, I could pass them. I enrolled in a couple of classes, but I kept failing them. And, I didn't fail them. I had to disenroll so that I wouldn't have to pay the Air Force for those classes that I was going to fail. So I winded up going to the Education Center, and I said, look, could you assess me and let me know what my reading and math level was? So they did an assessment on me, and that was embarrassing, and that hurt because I found out at that point that I had a seventh grade reading level and I had a fifth grade math level. And I asked the guy, the counselor, I said, what do I need to do in order to build that up? And he told me, he said, start reading, just read. He said, but don't read the dictionary, encyclopedia, nothing like that. He said, just read books that you like. And so I started reading these books, and there was this series of books called The Destroyer, The Death Merchant, and The Executioner.
There we go.
And because I was into martial arts at the time, this guy who was the destroyer, and they all three had the same type person. He could go in behind enemy lines, and he was so quick, he could dodge bullets and all this other stuff. You know, it was just amazing. It didn't make any sense, but it sounded good to me. I just started reading every one of them I could get. And in 6 months, I went back for a second assessment, and they said that my comprehension level and reading level was at the 11th grade. Oh. And then I re-enrolled in college, and I did the same thing with my math. I started with college arithmetic, which was not even a credit. And then I did my Algebra 1, and I ended up at the end completing calculus with analytical geometry, and then eventually I went to physics and completed physics as well and just kept going.
So then you decided to get a degree.
I was actually shocked. I had been taking classes left and right, my bachelor's, business classes, just one class right after the other. When I went to Korea, I was taking classes, and just as many of them that I could take. And then I went to Spain in Europe, and I kept right on taking business classes because I liked the business classes. I had a familiarization with them. They were fun. They would come pretty easy for me to do. And so I went to the education office, and this is another one of those moments like my my teacher, when I failed, I thought I had failed the first course I took. I went to the education office. They said they were going to have the University of Maryland advisor in to assess where you were for your degree. So I said, great, I have never had this assessment. So I go inside and I said, hey, I said, this is my file and everything. They pulled my education records, and the University of Maryland, which is the school I was going at that time, he said, oh, yeah, you're doing fine. He said, you're 3 credits shy from your degree. I said, yes, and I'm happy. I said, God, I only need 3 more classes to get my associate's degree. I'm doing great. I'm absolutely ecstatic. I'm so happy. And he stops a minute. He looks at me. He begins to go back through his file again, and he says, you haven't applied for your associate's degree. I said, no. He said, you're 3 credits shy of your bachelor's, 3 classes shy of your bachelor's degree. And I said, what? And I hadn't even realized it. I was just taking classes, still no focus and completely lost, young kid still. And I wound up completing those last 3, a history, U.S. history class, and I think it was a psychology and a business class. And I graduated, and that was it.
You are focused now. John Williams, principal of Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill. More of our conversation on the state of things in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest, John Williams, principal of Phoenix Academy High School, an alternative school. It's a high school in Chapel Hill. So when we left you, you were thrilled that you didn't even realize you were only 3 credits short of your associate's degree. Lo and behold, it is actually a bachelor's degree. You went on to get a graduate degree, postgraduate degrees.
Right? Yeah, actually, I received 2. I was then eventually stationed at Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida, and enrolled in a counseling program, counseling and human development, from Troy State University, and finished my first master's at Troy State University, and eventually graduated from East Carolina University with my master's in school administration.
What made you decide on education and counseling?
The counseling part came extremely natural to me, and it continues to be an extremely natural gift that I have. So being a counselor, I had always wanted to be. Once I had been in the military about 11 or 12 years, I saw that people gravitated toward me to talk about issues. I'm not one to give advice. I think giving advice is not healthy because it doesn't allow the people to work out their issues themselves. You're actually circumventing their own growth process. So, and I found that very, very helpful in working with people. So I went on through the counseling program and went through it, tested in the state of Florida. There was 2 tests, a law part as well as the practical part of practicing counseling, and passed it and went into private practice for a while down in Florida. Education, that was interesting. I moved up to North Carolina from Florida to take care of my mom. She was getting older. Even though we didn't have the best relationship as a child, I've always tried to do right by my mom and by anybody. You know, I tried to do right. And I felt that I was in a better position than all of my brothers to be able to move my family. So my wife and my 3 daughters, we closed the practice down, and I sold part of it to another counselor, and we moved up here. And it was by accident. I was leaving Snow Hill, where she still lives, to come to Raleigh to apply for some counseling positions. I had a couple of interviews set up, and I said, well, let me just drop off a resume at the education center. And I dropped it off, and I never left. And they hired me that day, that afternoon, in the interview, and I was hired as a lateral entry EC teacher at that time.
You did some teaching, though, in the Air Force, right?
I did more college teaching. Mm-hmm. Once I finished my master's, I was able to teach at Gulf Coast Community College. I taught the psychology class, sociology, and cultural diversity in education at the community college, and I did that for several years.
Well, tell us about that job in Greene County when you took that education job, because you very quickly became an administrator, right?
Yeah, I'm actually happy about this part. And I've had two situations, the situation where I actually became a counselor in the Air Force, as well as how I became an administrator. That's pretty unique. And I came in as a lateral entry EC teacher.
And what is that?
You're an exceptional children teacher, but you're laterally entered into the education system because you don't have the full North Carolina certification. So there are certain things you have to do. Typically, they give you about 3 years to complete all of your coursework and any internship or whatever you need to be able to meet the qualifications. But I never had an opportunity to do that. About 3 months, I was hired at the end of July, and I started seeing the students came to school somewhere around mid-late August. And October the 28th, I was actually hired as assistant principal. So I only taught for about 2 months. Wow. As an educator before I became an assistant principal.
Wow. So now you're an administrator in the public education system after years in the Air Force.
Right.
Did any of that training apply, or was it almost, did it conflict?
There's no conflict at all. In fact, I often credit the Air Force for saving my life. I needed to leave the town that I left and to go in to get away and to begin to grow because I was just didn't know what was going on. It's humbling to realize how ignorant that I was at that time. So the skills that I learned in the Air Force, every bit of it, as well as my retirement, I continue to proudly proclaim my commitment to the United States Air Force and what we stood for at that time. And I use those skills and with my counseling skills, my management skills in what I do.
I wonder what it was like for you to see kids coming through that school now in Greene County after all those years. You talked about being in trouble. It sounds to me like you might have gone in a very different path that could have taken you in a very different direction and probably had friends who maybe didn't make it out of there.
Right.
Now you're seeing kids who may have looked just like you, may have reminded you a lot of yourself. What was your experience now as a teacher having gone through all of that, coming back to the very place where you grew up?
You know, if you're talking about Greene County, just Greene County alone, I had a full commitment to that community and town to try to save as many children as I could. They just don't know what they don't know. They really don't know. In fact, I remember having that same conversation with a principal when I first became an assistant principal. I had thought that one day I wanted to be a principal, and I was just eager. And the longer I was an assistant principal, the more I realized how little I knew about being a principal. And one of the friends of mine who was the principal at Riverside when I first moved up here to North Carolina, to Durham area, he told me, he said, John, until you actually sit in the seat, you really don't know what it's like. So me having the opportunity to have an impact on those children because they just don't know. And it felt like they were all my family, and they still, many of them still feel as though I was their family.
Let me ask you about something you said just a second ago, this impulse to save as many kids as possible. That sounds like a dangerous impulse to me, if I may, because there are kids you won't save.
Right.
And so you're going to have a career in which you're going to try everything.
Right.
And it's not going to work. And if the goal is to save, can that not lead to burnout? How do you keep the passion for what you're doing and the goal without seeing those moments when it doesn't work out as failure and destructive to you?
Well, one of the things I try to stay focused on is that I can't let my passion be the driver or the deliverer of what I do for serving the children that I serve. Passion I associate more with emotions, and if it's my emotions that's driving it, I think the children as well as the staff and the team that I'm accountable to will be compromised. What I try to let drive me is always trying to do what's right by those that I'm trusted to serve. So that's one of the things that, first of all, keeps me focused and keeps me driven to make the right decisions all the time without getting emotionally becoming emotionally compromised because I don't feel as great today or tomorrow whatsoever. So I always try to stay focused on doing what's right. Number two, when I first went into counseling, I really was struggling one day. I said, you know, I don't know how in the world I can continue to hear about all of these devastating things, because I was doing more domestic violence and family counseling. And I was learning about sexual abuse with clients who was coming in. I was learning about people who have lost people who were close to them and all of this other stuff. And I said, you know, there's no way I can keep this. And one day I had a day of reckoning, and I just feel as though spiritually I was dealt with. And what happened, I learned that I needed to treat everyone's problem as if it was my own, if it came into my realm of responsibility. But the key secret to keep me from burning out was that I could never claim the problem as my own. So it's just like the children that I serve. I want to save every one of them. And if I have to show up at work at 12 o'clock at night to try to save one, then my wife knows, hey, listen, John's on his way out the door. It's 12 o'clock at night, because that's what I'm going to do. But at the end of the day, if I can't, I realize I've done everything that I can. And I think the key for me, Frank, that allows me to sleep very peacefully at night is that I know that I've done everything that I can. And whether I was able to save that one, that student, or whether I was just able to save this family, I've done my part, and I can live with that. And it's the same thing where, even like I said, I came up here to North Carolina to look out for my mom. I can do everything. As long as I'm doing her right, I'm doing everything that I can. Whenever time comes when we're separated for some reason, I'm okay. I'm okay. I've done what was right. And it wasn't out of passion or how I feel. It was because I'm trying to do what's right.
What are the outcomes for kids who go to Phoenix? First of all, how long do they generally stay? Are they there for 4 years, several years, just a short stay?
It varies. It varies a lot. And because a lot of times we're able to identify areas that was causing the child to struggle academically or emotionally in their other environment. And because we're smaller, we're able to identify it quicker and pinpoint exactly what we need to do to actually help the student become successful and continue to grow. So many times students have come for 1 year and they're gone. They go back to the other school and are very successful. We have retained a student for up to 3 years and they graduated out of Phoenix. We sometimes get them for 1 year and they graduate out of Phoenix out of that year. So it just varies a lot, but our focus is not to do long-term interventions for these students. Our focus is how do we make sure that these students are prepared to be successful, not just to get them across the stage, because that's not my focus. It's to prepare them to be successful after they graduate from high school. Graduation is simply a point in the process. It is not the ultimate be-all. Ultimately, I want them to be able to take care of their family, be able to provide for the children, and not have to depend on someone else.
Phoenix Academy has been recognized as a PBIS model school, Positive Behavior Interventions and Supports, and that was by the U.S. Department of Education. What does that mean, and what is it that they say other schools should be looking at and perhaps replicating? What in particular?
You know, I think one of the things that has to happen, you asked me about why we don't have an SRO. I'm sure somewhere down the line, we will probably eventually have a fight in the school. I've been there, this is 3.5, going on 4 years now, and we haven't had a physical fight, altercation in the school since I've been there. I say that, and I preface your answering your question with that statement, because it is not enough to stop suspending students out of a school if the students are behaving and being disruptive. You have to replace that behavior with something. So you don't say, well, I'm just going to stop suspending students and let them sit up there and tear up your school. There's got to be a positive or something that you're putting in place to reduce that negative or inappropriate behavior. And that's what PBIS is all about, is how do we begin to show the children that they are worth more than what they had previously thought they were, and change and enhance that self-confidence and self-belief in them, what they can do and accomplish. We have teachers who will stay late almost every day of the week to work with those students. When students realize that you are deeply involved, I can say things and do things with my students to get them in order and in place that not the average person can do. I can fuss at a student and tell them, no, this is the way it's going to be. And they will, because they feel as though I'm not just a principal, I'm a parent. That's like my daddy telling me, or my, some people think my grandfather, but I don't like to focus on that too much. But anyhow, that's like my daddy talking to me. I better get in line. So establishing those relationships and realizing that we have to have some positive interventions, not just negative consequences. And even though we do suspend students sometimes, they understand it's not because it's personal. This is a rule you violated. You knew the consequences. So, okay, we deal with it. But when you come back, the arms are open. I expect to get my hug, and you're going to expect a hug from me. And we're going to go right back in, and I'm going to continue to look out for you.
There's probably no one who can hear your personal story and not conclude that there's a lot about your sense of yourself coming of age and gaining confidence in yourself that you don't bring to the job and perhaps see in other students. But it does lead to the question, how much of this is about personal character and personality, and how much of it is replicable and systemic? Can we kind of build a system, or do we have 150,000 John Williams around the nation to teach and to administer?
No, I think that, as I tell most people, and people think that I'm showing a false sense of humility, but the staff that I serve is simply amazing. So it's not about John Williams. It really is not. And I refuse to allow anyone to even continue to think that John Williams is that awesome of a principal. I'm not. I have a staff that I would put up against any 12 educators in any district and 14 educators in any district, and they will blow the pants off of them. It's just they're going to do their job. So I think it's more so selecting. There was a book that I read several years ago, and we did a book study on, called Good to Great. And one of the first requirements in building an organization was getting the right people on the bus, the right people at the right place, right time. And that's what has happened, and has happened at the two schools that I've had a chance to serve, that we were able to bring in some very strong people who care deeply, not just about a paycheck and a job, but about saving children's lives.
John Williams, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you, too.
John Williams is the principal of Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill, an alternative high school in the Chapel Hill-Carrboro City School District. You can find out more about this and other things we talk about on the State of Things at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tybe. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Budarski sitting in today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.